Certainly, it is a blessing to have that foretaste of deliverance. It is our unwavering, because Christ was resurrected, and we rejoice in this. Our scripture text this morning, as we continue through the Gospel of Matthew, comes from Matthew chapter 9, verses 27 through 34. Matthew writes, "As Jesus passed on from there, two blind men followed him, crying aloud, 'Have mercy on us, Son of David.' When he entered the house, the blind men came to him and said to them, 'Do you believe that I am able to do this?' And they said to him, 'Yes, Lord.' Then he touched their eyes, saying, 'According to your faith, be it done to you.' And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly them, 'See that no one knows about it.' But they went away and spread this fame through all that district. And as they were going away, behold, a demon-possessed man who was mute was brought to him. And when the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke. And the crowds marveled, saying, 'Never was anything like this seen in Israel.' But the Pharisees said, 'He cast out demons by of demons.'" This is the word of the Lord. As we've been walking through the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus has revealed more and more to us who he is. He's been unpacking his identity through who he is and what he does. And we've learned many different aspects of his character. We've seen his authority, but we've also seen his compassion. We've observed his humility and also his divinity. The picture begins to emerge with each one of these narrative accounts, the historical Jesus, but that we might actually know him for who he truly is through eyes of faith. As we meet Jesus here in these narratives that God has recorded and preserved for us by the inspiration of the Spirit, we are challenged to actually do something with what we learn. We are challenged to believe. So it's important that when we read and consider the Gospel of Matthew, that we have as our goal the very strengthening of our faith in Christ. As Christians, especially as Protestant Christians in the Reformed tradition, we talk a lot about saving faith. The doctrine of sola fide, that salvation is by faith alone, is one of the pillars of our Reformed tradition. But what do we really mean when we talk about saving faith? What is faith that actually saves a person from the penalty of all their sins and misdeeds? Well, the story we see this morning in Matthew's Gospel teaches us exactly what saving faith is. And the first thing we see is this, is that saving faith sees Jesus for who he truly is. Matthew's been careful to show us through this his narrative account of Jesus' ministry how one by one, all the affirmities and afflictions must bow to the authority of Christ the Lord. From death itself, as we saw last week, to the paralyzed man, to those who are struck with other illnesses, Jesus has confirmed that he is Lord over all these things, reaching even to the dark, unknown parts of the grave. And in all those miracles, not only the authority of Christ stands out to us, that he has power to actually heal and redeem and save, but his compassion, his mercy. And we will read later in chapter 9, in verse 36, that when Jesus sees crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus loved the loveless. He cared for the sick. He fed the hungry. He forgave those who committed great transgressions. And he lifted up the fallen. And we see him doing that yet again, this time with these two blind men. Now, blindness and diseases of the eye appear to be very common during the time of Jesus' earthly ministry. It's thought because of the intense sun of the region, dusty conditions, and an agrarian society where people spent much time out of doors, that there was an awful lot of blindness or weakness or diseases of the eye. Now, something we should consider when we think of blindness at this time was how much more it would have severely limited a person compared to today. I mean, in our modern era, we have thankfully, a host of services available for the blind. We've developed things like Braille so they can read and learn and grow and contribute to society. We have trained service dogs to help them. We've redesigned our infrastructure in a way to assist those who cannot see. But in the first century, none of that existed. So, like many other disabilities, to be blind meant that one would be resigned to a very miserable way of life. Most blind people in Jesus' day were beggars. It was the only way they had to earn something to survive on. And what a humiliating way to live life. Day after day, spent either sitting in the street or walking down it amongst the crowd, carefully and slowly, crying out for bread, hoping that somebody might have enough compassion to reach out and help them and give them something so they didn't starve. That's what these two men were doing when Jesus passed by their part of town. And what is so remarkable about this story, though, is what the men say. Because instead of following after Jesus and crying out bread or asking for money, they cry out instead, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." Now, theologically, the foundation for that title that they call Jesus, the Son of David, was laid out for us in Matthew chapter 1, in that genealogy. It was about 20 weeks ago, actually, that we looked at that. We saw that Jesus comes from the line of David in his human nature. But let's pause for a moment to consider what exactly that title means. Because this is the first time of seven in the Gospel of Matthew that we see that phrase, the Son of David, applied to Jesus Christ. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, King David, Israel's greatest king until Christ came, declares that he wants to build a house for the Lord. And his desire is based upon the covenant promise of God to dwell with his people. A house is a place of dwelling. David wants to build an actual house where God can dwell amongst the people. And the Lord responds to David with this question: "Would you build me a house to dwell in?" I mean, you think about it, you cannot contain the infinite, unchangeable God in a house. And so God tells David, he says, instead of you building me a house, I'm going to build you a house. And what God means by that is not a physical house. He's talking about David's line. David already has a beautiful palace made out of cedar. But God promises in a covenant that through David there would be a king who would build a house for God's name and whose throne would be established forever. And of course, we think of Solomon building the temple, he built the house, but Solomon was not the king whose throne was established forever. There's another house in mind behind that promise. This king, according to 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, would be called the Son of David, but would also be called a Son of God. Furthermore, he would lead his people into a time of rest from their enemies. And so when these two blind men call Jesus the Son of David, they are acknowledging by faith that he is that promised king of David's line, whose throne would be established forever. Furthermore, he is going to build a house, a different kind of house, not made with hands, a spiritual house, who is the people of God. He is the king that would build a house, that is the church, and in them God would dwell with his people forever. He is the king that would give his people rest from all striving and suffering. He is the king who is also the Son of God. That's what they were saying when they said, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." So saving faith then, which sees Jesus as he truly is, acknowledges that he is that one, that long-awaited Son of David, that king who fulfills every one of God's promises, and who is building a house for God and his people to dwell together. It sees him as the Son of God. The Word became flesh, who dwelt among us that he might redeem us. As Athanasius famously wrote, "Christ became like us that we might become like him." And seeing Jesus like that is to see him in a fundamentally different way than the which many people view him, even today. It means that Jesus wasn't just some historical figure who influenced the world, some revolutionary character of history. It means that he was more than just a moral teacher who said some things that are helpful in how we live and treat others. It means that he is the Son of God. That's how saving faith sees Jesus. I mean, we don't even have faith in the idea of faith. We have faith in a person, the person of Jesus Christ, as he declared himself to be God in the flesh, the fulfiller of all redemption's promises. Now, to see him like that, though, means that God must do something within the heart of a person for them to understand that Jesus is this Son of David, who is also the Son of God. Now remember who's making this declaration of Jesus. It is two blind men. They never saw him. They had no idea what he looked like. And yet they say with confidence that he is the Son of David. In fact, Jesus hasn't called himself that, as far as we know, in his teachings up to this point in the Gospel of Matthew. And yet they call him the Son of David. How did they know that? They knew it because God had revealed it to him through the words that Christ proclaimed. There was no doubt through Jesus' teaching that he was this king of great authority. And hearing those words, God used them to create faith in those blind men's heart. And that is how God always creates faith in the heart, even to this day. If you are a believer, if you are looking to Christ, it is because God, through his word, has given you that faith. Romans 10:17. So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. So the first thing we learn about saving faith, it sees Jesus for who he truly is. But secondly, saving faith sees Jesus for what he truly can do. The blind men, they enter into the house where Jesus is staying at that time. And there, away from the noise of the crowded streets, Jesus asks them this probing question. He says, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" Now, we've seen the priority of faith before in Matthew's gospel associated with miracles. It's been an essential factor in all the healing narratives we've read up to this point. The centurion in chapter 8 voluntarily confessed his faith in Jesus' authority. The unnamed leper in that same chapter did the same thing. Jesus saw the faith of the paralyzed man and his friends before he healed them. And the woman with the hemorrhage declared her faith and was delivered from that infirmity. This question from Jesus, though, is a little different. This is the first time And the only time in all of Matthew's gospel that we observe Christ actually asking the person, "Do you believe?" And the emphasis of this miracle narrative is very much then on the necessity of actually believing that Jesus can do what he says he can do. Notice Jesus doesn't ask the blind men if they believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Redeemer of his people. They've already confessed that. They've already said that he is the Son of David. They knew who Jesus was. They believed that to be true. So Jesus asked them, "Well, since you believe I am that king, do you believe then I am able to do this, that I am able to deliver you from your blindness, that I am able to extend to you mercy? Do you believe that I can deliver you from this affliction?" And this is especially significant when we consider how people in the Bible viewed blindness. While God's people have been commanded to show compassion and care, as per the instructions of Leviticus 19:14, for example, it is also true that blindness carried a religious stigma. Blindness was often portrayed as a judgment of God, both metaphorically and practically. For example, in the list of curses that would fall upon the nation of Israel if they willfully turned away from the Lord and violated the law, we read these words: "The Lord will strike you with madness and blindness and confusion of mind, and you shall grope at noonday as the blind grope in the darkness, and you shall not prosper in your ways." Also, we consider that when the men of Sodom tried to break down the door of Lot's house, God struck those men with blindness to protect the people inside. When the Syrians went to war with God's people, the prophet Elisha prayed, "Please strike these people with blindness." Now, we've been careful to observe in the past, so we need to note again that we should never assume that infirmities and disabilities that a person has have come upon them as judgment. In fact, Jesus addresses that later, even regarding a blind person. In John chapter 9, another man is blind, and the disciples ask, "Well, why? What caused this? Was it his sin or his parents?" And Jesus says, "No, it was neither." However, we equally recognize that afflictions and tragedies exist because we live in a sin-cursed world. Furthermore, spiritual blindness is the way the Bible often portrays unbelief or lack of faith. And so when Jesus asked these blind men if they believed he could actually restore their sight, there was no doubt a spiritual side to that question. To remove the physical affliction meant that he had power over sin's curse itself. And the blind men respond to Jesus when he asks, "Do you believe I can do this?" They respond, and two blind men. God wrote through the prophet Isaiah, and he described the power of his salvation that would come upon his people when the deliverer of his people arrived. Isaiah 35, verses 3 through 6, we read these words: "Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with a vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For the waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert." That deliverer that Isaiah spoke about so long ago is Jesus Christ. And for these two blind men, Isaiah's prophecy is about to be fulfilled in a very personal way. So upon their response of faith, Jesus touches their eyes, and instantly they are able to see. They're able to see because Jesus was not only the Son of David, but he is the Son of David who could actually do what he promised to do, save people from affliction. So saving faith sees Jesus for what he can actually do. In other words, saving faith believes that Jesus truly came to save and redeem and restore and reverse the curse of sin upon this world. But there's a third thing that saving faith sees. So it sees Christ for who he truly is. It sees him for what he can truly do. But saving faith also sees yourself for who you truly are. And that is someone in need of his saving mercy. After having their sight restored, Jesus urged the blind man not to tell anybody about what had happened. And we see this come up in Matthew. We see it a lot in Mark. This is something that Bible scholars and theologians call a messianic secret. And it's kind of confusing. I mean, why would Jesus want to hide his identity as the Messiah? Well, there are several reasons for it, and we could spend a lot of time unpacking them and considering them. But for the sake of time, I just want to mention a couple of things. First of all, Jesus isn't looking for fame and fortune when he does all these miracles. That actually stands in contrast to the so-called miracle workers of today. He doesn't perform miracles to get noticed, to have people follow him, simply because he's a miracle worker. Rather, he performs them out of mercy for his people and to confirm to those who did bear witness to him that he truly is the Christ. Secondly, it is quite possible that Jesus needed rest from his ministry. In fact, we see him more than once throughout the Gospels needing to come away from the crowds for a while just to get a little bit of rest. Remember, while he had a divine nature, he also had a human nature. And that means he got tired and he got hungry just like we did. So by asking the blind men to keep the restoration of their sight silent, he's trying to get some relief from the crowds that followed him. Regardless of the reason why Jesus says this, though, the word gets out. The blind men, of course, they can't keep that to themselves. And Christ in his divinity knew that. And they go out and everybody hears. He's given sight again to these blind men. And as a result of that, the people bring before Jesus another man with another infirmity. This man was unable to speak, and his muteness was attributed to demon possession. Now, what's so unique about this miracle is Matthew really doesn't give us any details of how it actually transpired. It just said that when the demon was cast out, the man was able to speak. He doesn't tell us what Jesus actually did. Did he touch the man's mouth? What words did he say? We don't know. And that's because the focus for this miracle is upon the response to it rather than the miracle itself, particularly the response by the Pharisees. There are two responses we actually see here. The first one is by the crowd, the other by the Pharisees. And the crowd replies, "Never was anything like this seen in Israel." Now, this is a summary reaction to all the miracles we've seen unfolding through Matthew 8 and 9. It's sort of like what the crowd said at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Remember that? The crowds, they heard Jesus teaching and they were amazed because he taught not like the religious leaders, but as one who had authority. This would be something similar. The summary here, after all these kingdom-confirming, mercy-rich miracles by Jesus, is that they had never seen anybody do anything like that before. And they hadn't. Now, God had certainly moved throughout Israel's history, throughout redemptive history, in miraculous ways, but not to the extent that Jesus was performing these miracles. And everywhere Jesus went, healing followed. Why? Because that long-awaited kingdom was dawning upon the world, and Jesus' miraculous power helped confirm that that is what was happening. You see, saving faith is more than just an opinion. In fact, it isn't an opinion about Jesus. I mean, opinions are actually based on little or no evidence. We have all sorts of opinions. But faith is actually based on things that happened, reasonable realities that can be observed and tested, things that have been recorded for us through history. And the primary testimony of who Jesus is and what he does is the scriptures themselves. And the historical realities of Christ have been tested and tried again and again so that we can trust the testimony of the Bible when it speaks of Christ. And that is what these people were affirming. There's nothing been done like this in Israel before. This must be the Messiah. But there was another group of people during the time of Jesus' ministry on earth who refused to believe that despite the overwhelming evidence that was playing out before their very eyes. Now, they couldn't deny the miracles. Notice they don't try to do that. They don't say, no, you're definitely still blind. It was obvious these guys could see. And other miracles were similar. They couldn't look at the lame man and say, no, you're still disabled. He was up walking around carrying his bed with him. They saw the miracles. So instead, they have to try to turn to other explanations. And the one they throw out here is very irrational. They say, well, he casts out demons by the prince of demons. Now, this accusation is going to come up again in Matthew chapter 12. And Jesus is going to respond to it and expose it for the error that it is. And we'll look at it in more detail when we come to that part of Matthew's gospel. But for now, the important thing to see is that what the Pharisees couldn't see. They were more blind than the two blind men when it came to seeing Jesus for who he really was and what he could do. And they were blind to seeing themselves for who they really were. They were people who needed Christ's mercy just as much as the blind men or the demon-possessed mute. And that's what saving faith sees when it looks upon one's own heart, a need for mercy. Remember what the blind men cried when they followed Jesus? They said, Son of David, have mercy on us. They knew that the only way they could be restored is if Jesus acted out of mercy. Mercy always comes from one who has power to one who is powerless, from one who is strong to one who is weak, from one who has much to one who is poor. And when we see our need for Christ's mercy, we see our humble estate as sinners before him. And we ask him to heal us, to restore us, even though we are undeserving of that healing and restoration. That's what the blind men could see when they looked at themselves and looked at their own hearts that the Pharisees could not see. So actual blind men in this story were the Pharisees, whose spiritual vision was obscured by their own self-righteous pride. And this leads us to ask this question then, how do I see Jesus? Do I see him as he truly is, the Son of David, the Messiah, the King, who is also the Son of God, who came to bring deliverance to his people? And do I see him for what he has truly done and what he truly does? That he went to a cross, that he died and he rose again the third day, conquering sin, Satan, and death. And now in him, there is forgiveness of sins forevermore. That he can actually pardon every wrongdoing that you have ever committed and wash away the stain of every last sin you have ever done. Do you see that he can truly do that? And how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as these blind men dead, men who needed mercy? Or do you see yourself as the Pharisees, as they saw themselves, self-righteous, better than everyone else, pretty good, God must be able to accept them. See, the answer to those questions, they make all the difference between belief and unbelief, between a faith that saves and just a head knowledge of Christ. They make all the difference between rejoicing and sorrow, salvation and condemnation, forgiveness and God's righteous judgment. So look to Jesus, look to him with eyes of faith, and see and rejoice for the mercy that gave sight to those blind men can give you sight as well. And every one of heaven's spiritual blessings is opened up to you through the mercy of Christ. So look to him and see him, for he truly is what he truly does, that he saves you who truly needs his mercy. Father in heaven, we do thank you for your word. We're thankful that you have placed within the hearts of your people a faith that actually redeems. That simply by looking to Christ, we can hear those words that we are forgiven, we are justified in your sight. Not because of what we have done, but because of what our King has done for us. So help us to remember these things who are your children. Help us to take them to heart this week and be strengthened in our faith and share them with those who need this mercy as much as we need. And if there be any who still do not know this mercy, we pray, Father, that you would give them eyes of faith, eyes to see who Jesus Christ truly is. We pray this in his name.